Good afternoon. Welcome to the Second Court of Appeals. As you can see, the panel has changed. To my right, Justice Bill Meyer.
Good afternoon.
To my left, Justice Lee Gabriel. I'm Leanne Dofino. And we have changed panels just to hear your case. So, understand both sides are ready. True. All right, then if you'll call the case, we'll get started.
The court will now call Texas Farmers Insurance Company and Farmers Insurance Exchange versus Frank Carrasco and Pamela Russ. May it please the court, Mr. Kent Chambers will argue for the appellant. Mr. Thomas B. Cowart will argue for the appellee.
Okay, thank you. Kent?
Mr. Chambers, where's Magnolia?
Pardon?
Where is Magnolia, Texas?
Magnolia is about 40 miles northwest of Houston near Tomball, the Woodlands.
I'm on Tomball, yes, sir. Okay, thank you.
Know where the Woodlands is?
Okay,
Conroe, the area, that kind of thing.
I know most of the towns in Texas, but I don't think I've ever been to Magnolia.
Well, it's not very big, so it's out there.
Thank you.
I appreciate the court taking the time to hear our case again. As you know, it's been pending for a while, and I know that the issues are somewhat complex due to the number of policies that are involved, the number of exclusions under each policy, the number of conditions under each policy, the affirmative defenses that have been raised by Ms. Rust and Mr. Karosky. However, in reality, the court's task can be made simple by simply adhering to and following the Texas Supreme Court's guidance and directive in the Maldonado case, the Gandy case, the two cases from the Texas Supreme Court which have held that an insured who is being defended by his insurer, whether under a reservation of rights or otherwise, if he is being provided a defense and he goes out and he enters into an agreed judgment with his opponent, the plaintiff, who in this case happens to be Mr. Karosky's daughter, Ms. Rust.
Who is he?
I'm sorry. Mr. Karosky.
No, you're saying if he goes out and enters, you're talking about the lawyer or you're talking about the plaintiff?
The insured, the defendant
insured.
In the bodily injury case.
Okay.
In this case, Ms. Rust was on a riding lawnmower and toppled down a hill and received some injuries, and she sued her father, who was the owner of the premises where the accident occurred and the owner of the lawnmower that she was riding at the time. And Mr. Karosky is insured under a Texas Farmers homeowner's policy, actually two, because he owned two homes. He had his homeowner's policy on his own residence, and he had the homeowner's policy. He and Ms. Rust had a homeowner's policy on her residence, and then he had an umbrella with Farmers Insurance Exchange. And what I'm saying is, when Mr. Karosky, as the insured, who was being defended by his insurers, Texas Farmers, when he decided to go out and to enter into an agreed judgment with Ms. Rust, for $300,000, he incurred an obligation, a judgment, a liability against himself, and the policies all state that that is not binding on the insurers without their written consent, without them signing off on it, or if it's a result of an actual trial on the merits. And that's what the Maldonado case says. This case is on all fours with the Maldonado case. In Maldonado, the policyholder was being sued for defamation. The plaintiff in the underlying case sent him a settlement demand for the policy limits. He tendered it to his insurer, and they said, "We're not settling the case within your limits." So instead of proceeding on and having a Stowers claim, he just said, "Well, I'll enter into a judgment myself." And the insurer, which was State Farm in that case, didn't consent to it. There was a kind of a mockery of a trial where they went down there and the plaintiff put on all of his evidence. The defense counsel didn't make an opening statement, didn't put on any evidence, and didn't make a closing argument. And then after a bench trial, there was a judgment. And the insured assigned his rights to the plaintiff, and the plaintiff sued State Farm directly and said, "Pay this judgment." And the Texas Supreme Court says when the insured who is being defended under his insurance policy by his insurer, if he's going to go out and strike his own deal, then he's going to end up being the one that's responsible for paying for his own deal. He cannot bind the insurance company to a deal that he strikes with the plaintiff when he's being defended.
There's a lot of discussion in these briefs about whether this accident was covered. Was it covered under the umbrella policy? Was it covered under this policy? Does it really matter? Can we say, even for sake of argument, it was covered, but the Gandy case and the Maldonado case mean that the insurance company is not bound by the agreed settlement between the plaintiff and the defendant?
It really doesn't matter in this sense. Farmers would have been entitled to summary judgment and is entitled to have the summary judgment in the plaintiff's favor reversed if either there was an exclusion that applied such that it wasn't covered, or if the insured breached the policy and failed to comply with the conditions of the insurance policy. So Ms. Rust, who has now stepped into Mr. Karofsky's shoes, has the burden of proving two things. One, that her claim, that the claim would have been covered under the policy, and secondly, that the insured, Mr. Karofsky, fully complied with the conditions of the policy in order for the coverage to apply. So you're correct in the sense that it doesn't matter, because if either of those two prongs is missing, then Mr. Karofsky is not covered under the policy. And that's why I'm saying that the court's task has been simplified immensely by the fact that Mr. Karofsky went out there and, in his words, struck his own deal with his daughter.
Let me ask you just exactly how it is simplified, because if, for argument's sake, this court were to agree with you and say that the insurance company is not bound by the settlement agreement, what other issues does this court really have to reach? Because there's other issues raised on appeal. What other issues do we really have to reach?
The court would still have to address Ms. Rust's affirmative defenses that she raised in her pleadings but had no evidence of, which is waiver and estoppel. I think the court, in order to fulfill its responsibilities to address all the issues in the case, would have to respond to those affirmative defenses. And our position is that we conclusively established, well, the plaintiff failed to prove two things. The plaintiff failed to conclusively establish her own affirmative defenses of waiver and estoppel such that it was improper for the trial court to grant summary judgment in her favor. Secondly, the court could reverse and render because there was, we filed our own motion for summary judgment saying that there's no evidence of at least one or more of those elements, and they didn't come forward with those elements in order to have at least some evidence of those affirmative defenses. So in my view, the court can simply say, under Maldonado and the Gandy opinion, which is another opinion which stands for the same proposition that there's no sweetheart deals in Texas like this, address that and then address the affirmative defenses they've raised, reverse because they didn't prove them, and then render because we filed a no evidence motion and they didn't come forward with any evidence of waiver or estoppel.
What is your response to their argument that the insurance company actually did agree to the settlement because the attorney for Mr. Karofsky signed it?
First of all, that issue was not raised until we were on appeal. That was not a basis for summary judgment in the trial court, and there's no evidence in the trial court summary judgment record one way or the other with respect to, well, there's no evidence in the record to indicate that he had Farmers' authority to sign on their behalf. Secondly, it makes no sense because Farmers retained Jason Thomas to represent Mr. Karofsky, and the Texas Supreme Court has made it very clear in the Tilley case that when you're counsel for an insured and you're being paid by the insurer, you owe your sole duty and allegiance to the insured, the policyholder who's being sued. He could not also be representing Farmers and signing off it in its behalf. And if you look at the pleadings, the judgment, in the underlying case, it says Jason Thomas, counsel for defendant, who in that case was Karofsky. So there's no evidence. We raised the issue. that he settled without our consent, and we're not bound by it. It would have been a defense to our position for him to say, oh, yes, you did consent to it, and here's some evidence of it. They never raised that in the trial court. Had they, then we certainly, could have done some discovery and maybe taken Jason Thomas's deposition and found out whether he also represented farmers. But so it's an issue that they had the burden on. They didn't raise it. They didn't have any evidence of it. And now they've raised it for the first time on appeal. So in my opinion, they've waived it. But even so, it's not something that even makes sense under Texas law, since under the Tilley Doctrine, he owed his duty solely to Mr. Karosky. I do think that the exclusions, you raise the issue, well, what are the exclusions really important to begin with? They provide some context for why this controversy got started in the first place, if nothing else. And farmers took the position when Mr. Karosky was sued that this arose out of his rental property, which he didn't list on his policy. It arose out of other premises, which were not listed on his policy. He had on his own homeowner's policy, he had a schedule of other rental properties that he wanted covered under that policy. This one wasn't on it. And so farmers did have a reasonable basis for saying, hey, we think that this might not be covered. And farmers had, under the Gandy opinion, had an obligation to file the declaratory judgment action, which is this case, to seek a ruling. Under Gandy, it says if the insurer is defending you and seeking in good faith a judicial determination of whether its coverage issues are justified, then the policyholder cannot go out and strike his own deal, because he needs to wait to see what happens, and then if he's right, then it will be covered, and if the insurance company is right, then it won't be covered. So that provides some background for why this got started. But secondly, they're now taking the position, if you read Mr. Karosky's affidavit in the trial court in this case, in the summary judgment record, he says, when farmers sued me to try to avoid coverage, I decided to strike my own deal, and I entered into this agreed judgment against himself. So the declaratory judgment action that farmers filed, and which farmers had a duty to file under the Gandy opinion, because they're required to seek in good faith a judicial determination when they say there's no coverage, they're saying should be used against farmers as a basis for allowing Mr. Karosky to enter into a judgment against himself and then make farmers pay for it. So the very thing that the Supreme Court requires farmers to do in Gandy, to file a declaratory judgment action, is what Mr. Karosky says dooms farmers in this case, because it enables him, it's the trump card that he can point to and say, oh, well, farmers sued me, so I had the right to go out and strike this deal. And it makes no sense. Farmers was not only right, but was required to file the declaratory judgment action when these exclusions became triggered by the pleadings against Mr. Karosky. So the exclusions, which are briefed at length, the accident arose out of rental property, the accident arose out of premises that were not listed on his policy, and then under the umbrella, there's an exclusion for accidents that arise out of the ownership, maintenance, or use of real property, unless it is real property that's listed on the schedule of underlying insurance, which this one was not.
How did it arise out of real property? Because of the slanted portion of the yard?
Yes, the pleadings against Mr. Karosky were that the slope was such that he should have put a fence around it. It was also pled that he watered it right before, maybe, I don't remember if it was in the pleadings or if it was in the affidavit.
Okay. I understand those two things, and right. That's your answer to what I just asked you. What about the contention on the part of Ms. Rust that there was no reservation of rights letter and there was no agreement for a non-waiver agreement?
Well, that has to be put into context. The absence of a reservation of rights letter does not give rise to waiver or estoppel. And that's the
Ulico
opinion.
I go with you on that part. Right. What I'm asking you, though, is that the law dealing with what we're talking about, what we used to call Wilkinson exceptions, where is that if you don't have a reservation of rights or you don't have a non-waiver agreement and you provide counsel, that's saying that you're, by doing those things without anything else, you're stopped from asserting any policy defenses like are being asserted here on the umbrella policy.
Yes, Your Honor, there's a Utica and a Ulico, so I'm trying to keep them straight.
Yes.
The Ulico opinion from the Texas Supreme Court expressly disapproves of the Wilkinson case, and it says that an insurer may be stopped under some circumstances from relying on a condition. So if the insurer is defending the policyholder, there's no reservation of rights, and they mislead the policyholder into thinking that he does not have to comply with, let's say, a condition that he send the suit papers because they're already defending him. They can't come back at the end of the case and say, oh, well, you never sent us the suit papers, and then deny coverage on the basis that he didn't meet one of the conditions. Now, I understand that conditions are in play in this case, but there's no evidence that Farmers in any way misled Mr. Kurowski. To the contrary, he says, when I received the suit papers against me seeking a judicial declaration that there was no coverage, I decided to go out and breach the policy. So in context, it would have been an issue that they would have the burden of proof on, and in and of itself, it doesn't change the policy. If there were other evidence like unfairness, prejudice, and deception, then it may give rise to estoppel, which could enable him to get his damages, of which there's also no evidence. And I see that my time is up.
Questions?
Did I finish your?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Do you go by Thomas or Tom?
Good afternoon. May it please the court. And I'd like to echo Mr. Chambers' expression of gratitude to the court for allowing us to show back up and redo this one. I appreciate the opportunity to stand in front of y'all today with co-counsel Scott Perry, who's sitting with me at council table. Your Honor, my plan is to kind of briefly address the structure of my brief and why I presented the case the way I did in my brief, why that makes sense, then talk about the Ulico case, and then talk about Gandy. Gandy issues in the case. That's kind of my roadmap of my argument. The reason I did my brief the way I did, I call it the Texas two-step. When you're litigating insurance coverage issues, the law is quite clear that the insured first has the burden to establish that the claim falls within the coverage, and then after they've successfully carried that burden, the insurance company then has the burden to come in and explain or show why it falls out of coverage, why it is that the claims that are being asserted or the damages that are being prosecuted aren't covered by the insurance policy. And that's kind of the model that I follow with my brief. I started with showing why it is that these particular claims fall within the umbrella policy's coverage. And remember, the other policies that are thrown around in the record that are in the brief extensively, they don't matter. The homeowners policies that are cited and discussed in the brief don't matter in this case because we only recovered under the umbrella policy. And we non-suited all of the extra contractual claims, and all the claims that related to the homeowners policies have been taken out of the case. So the only coverage here that we've pursued is under the umbrella policy. And that umbrella policy's coverage language is extremely broad. It's any claim for damages anywhere in the world within the policy period. And clearly, it's not a question of is there scheduled real estate or unscheduled real estate. It's any claim in the world, anywhere in the world that involves bodily injury. And the umbrella policy has a provision in there that says for claims that aren't covered by other insurance policies, we've got the duty to defend. We'll take over the defense, and we'll pay up to our limits, which, by the way, is $1 million. The umbrella policy is $1 million policy. So our summary judgment showing was just that these claims occurred here in Tarrant County within the policy period, and they were for bodily injury claims. And so that showing on our behalf in our summary judgment motion is sufficient to carry our summary judgment burden to get us across the finish line. Then it becomes
the conditions and the exclusions.
Then it becomes the insurance companies. Yes, ma'am. That's the second part of it, is that it's their duty to come in and say, oh, wait a minute, that's excluded. And that's where the Ulico case comes in. Because Ulico, and I disagree with counsel's description of what Ulico actually does. I mean, if you read the Ulico case, they talk about coverage. Coverage, 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 coverage. I don't know how many times they say that word in the opinion, but coverage and exclusions are two separate concepts in the insurance world, right? You got to get into coverage before you can pull it back out. I mean, there's case law out there that says that you can read it backwards. If you've excluded something, it essentially means that whatever it was you've excluded was originally covered, even if it's not clearly within the policy as being covered. Once it's excluded, that's the insurance company saying, oh, by the way, that was actually included, but we're taking it back. So my reading of Ulico is that they're talking about non-coverage defenses or non-coverage issues, which is to say, if you look at like the facts on Ulico, it's a claims made and reported policy. Claims made and reported policy. The insured is served with a lawsuit on like October 20th when the policy expires on October 25th. It's real close, 7 days, 10 days before the end of the policy period. They don't report it to the insurance company until after the policy period is concluded. Okay, so it's not an exclusion. It's something that's actually built into the coverage term of the policy and covering language. And so when the insured comes along and says, well, you were leading us along, you sent us a letter, a reservation of rights letter, and you didn't comment on the fact that you might be claiming this thing wasn't within the policy period, and the Supreme Court ultimately says, because it wasn't in the covering agreement itself, it wasn't in the coverage agreement, the covering agreement itself, you can't use waiver and estoppel to expand that. So you can't rewrite the coverage language. But that's our burden, is to show that it's in the coverage. What the other cases say is that if the insurance company doesn't properly reserve its right to assert its defenses of exclusion and exceptions, that those are the kind of things that are waived. So if you look at the cases that Ulico cites, the Murrah case, which is the Dallas Court of Appeals case, where the exclusion is it's an auto policy, and they say, but we exclude claims that arise out of DWI, basically, right? And they go through and they try the whole case, and then after the verdict, the insurance company comes in and says, oh, it's a DWI case, so we're out of here. And the court said, you can't do that. You can't not assert your exclusion in a reservation of right letter, and then assert it after you've represented the defendant, the insured. So
whether Ulico applies or not, estoppel for years has required a showing that the insured was prejudiced by the conduct of the insurer.
Yes,
so
ma'am.
What was the evidence that Mr. Kurowski was prejudiced, and that he believed his defense was being provided to him unconditionally, or that the company didn't reserve their rights? What's the evidence of that?
Well, I think there's a couple of thoughts there, Your Honor. I think that it's almost like if the insurance company, the insureds don't have a lot of rights. I mean, under the way the law is written today and the way the law stands, the insureds don't have a lot of privileges and rights in their policies. One of the things they have is they're entitled to rely on the insurance company to tell them what they're intending to do. And if an insurance company doesn't properly send out the reservation of rights letter, the fact that the insured takes over the insured's defense is prejudice in itself.
Do you have a case that says that it's just implied that there's prejudice and that you don't have to prove it?
I don't.
Just because your client denies receiving it when the evidence is it was sent to the address that was on the insurance policy?
Well, the evidence is that it was, that they say it was mailed. We say we didn't get it.
Okay.
To me, the question of the reservation rights, that the requirement on the insurance company is to effectively reserve their rights. They just can't post it on a bulletin board somewhere. They can't. In other words, Your Honor, what I'm trying to say is, if there's a question about that, that's a lick on them. All they had to do was...
Had a fact question then, and maybe there shouldn't have been a summary judgment granted?
Well, because it's their burden to show it in opposition to, and going back to that Texas two-step analysis, once we've carried our burden, they've got to come in and show that it's an excluded claim. In order to show it's an excluded claim, they got to show that they reserve their rights. So again,
You're
that's
saying
their
client's self-serving declaration that he didn't receive it is enough to meet your burden?
All evidence is self-serving at the end of the day, Your Honor. And their affidavit.
You know what I mean? Their affidavit. A conclusory affidavit by a party that's not supported by anything at all. You know what is meant by that.
Their affidavit is equally self-serving. It's an employee who says that she remembers sending a letter from 3 years previously, that she probably does this on a daily basis, but she remembers this one letter. So, I mean, it's equally self-serving, and it's their burden. It's their burden to show that they properly reserve their rights. Now, the other
what
part...
What is the evidence of prejudice?
The other part about, well, they took over our defense, and then they sued us out of the blue. They sued Mr. Karofsky out of the blue. Mr. Karofsky, apparently, because he says he didn't get the reservation of rights letter, he's clicking along with his insurance company provided attorney, and then out of the blue, he gets a lawsuit filed against him.
So if he's so supposed to believe, oh, well, they're providing me a defense unconditionally, then why would he turn around and say, well, when they sued me, I decided I was going to strike a deal and...
Because the insurance or the coverage litigation that he was served with says, we're not going to cover you. It says that we want a court order saying you're not entitled to indemnification at the end of the day here. So they sued him out of the blue as far as this record goes, because he says, I didn't have that reservation of rights letter. And then suddenly they dropped a lawsuit on him. And the lawsuit says, you're not entitled to coverage under the policy. So from his perspective, I would presume he's got a lawyer who suddenly is suspect, because it's provided by an insurance company that he didn't know was getting ready to sue him. He had no notice of that. And so I would argue that that's prejudicial. And in terms of the question about the relationship in between the insurance defense lawyer and the insurance company, you know, if you look at that Ranger versus Gwynn case that I've cited, they have a jury charge instruction in there that says that the attorney provided by the insurance company is a sub-agent of the insurance company. And then in later cases, the Tilly and the Traver case, the Supreme Court comes back along and says, well, they went on to say that the insurance company and Ranger versus Gwynn, the insurance company has all the agency duties that you would have as the agent of the insurer. The insurance company has those duties as well, to investigate, to handle, to all the kind of things that you would look to that lawyer to provide. Later on, the case law develops that, well, the insurance company isn't vicariously liable for the attorney's malpractice. But none of those cases take away the agency relationship in between the insurance defense attorney and the insurance company itself. In fact, if you look at those cases, when they're talking about the vicarious liability issue, they just don't say, well, that attorney's not an agent in the insurance company, therefore, end of story, which is what you would expect. If there's no relationship in between the insurance defense lawyer and the insurance company, then there's nothing to impute his misconduct or her misconduct to the insurance company.
Kelly doesn't say that the attorney's not the sub-agent of the insurance company?
I'm sorry, say that again?
Kelly doesn't say that the attorney is not the sub-agent of the insurance company?
No, ma'am. It says that the insurance defense attorney's sole duty of loyalty runs to the client. And if that duty is infringed by the insurance company, there becomes conflict, and that's a problem. But what those cases ultimately conclude is that the insurance company is not liable for the attorney's misconduct or malpractice because she's an independent contractor, because the attorney is an independent contractor. And so that's just standard independent contractor law. If I hire an independent contractor and I turn over all the job and everything that I want done to them, I'm not vicariously liable for their misconduct. That's standard law. But there's not a question about whether that lawyer or that contractor is my agent or not.
Well, they do say that the attorney's sole duty is to Mr. Karofsky in this instance.
As an attorney, yes, ma'am. But, you know, there's cases that come after that, at least one that the Bratt case out of Houston, 842 Southwest 2nd 56, could be 892, I better look at my better notes, but anyway, where it says we still agree with that the insurance defense attorney remains an agent of the insurance company, and I don't think there's a case out there that takes that away. Again, if you look at the vicarious liability cases, the reason that the insurance company is not vicariously liable for the insurance defense lawyer's malpractice is not because he's not their agent, but it's because he's an independent contractor, and you don't impute vicarious liability from the independent contractor.
Mr. Coward, whenever the declaratory judgment lawsuit was filed.
I'm sorry, Judge?
When the declaratory judgment lawsuit was filed here and served on Mr. Krosky, at that point in time, was the insurance company provided defense counsel continuing to represent him?
Yes, sir.
And continued to the point of signing off on an agreed judgment?
Yes, sir. About, where's my piece of paper? I've got the timeline written out, Judge. The deck action was filed on January 29th. Mr. Krosky and I believe the defense lawyer signed the agreed judgment on February 19th, and the trial court signed it on March 8th. Now, there's some intervening periods of time in there, but
was there any evidence presented as to any communications between defense counsel for Mr. Krosky and the insurance company?
No, sir. Not that I'm aware of.
Thank you.
And let me shift gears and talk about Gandy real quick before I completely run my clock out. I want to cite y'all to a case that's not in my brief. It's Evingston's versus Adofina, 256 Southwest 3rd, 660, Texas, 2008. In that case there, the Texas Supreme Court says that Gandy, and Maldonado doesn't cite, but Maldonado, I think, just follows Gandy. It says that it's confined to its unique elements, and the holding there is explicit and narrow. And you've got to hit all the elements within Gandy in order to get to the result that Gandy gets. And remember, Gandy is a really bad fact case. I mean, this is a deal where the lawyer who signs the agreement, who's representing the insured, a couple of weeks later, the insurance company calls him up. He's not getting paid by the insurance company. He's had no communication with the insurance company. They call him up and say, what's the status of the case? And he misrepresents it. He says, I don't know. I haven't reviewed the file yet, or language to that effect. They go in and they take the agreement, and they turn around and sue the State Farm, sue the insurance company directly. And as a result of, and the trial court says there's no duty to defend, and there's no indemnification requirement under that policy on these facts, but you can go ahead and prosecute the case on whether or not State Farm mishandled the case. And as a result of that, everybody's litigation motivations are switched around. Now suddenly the plaintiff in the underlying suit is saying, I wouldn't have gotten as much money out of the case if you had handled it correctly. So if you look, and I apologize, Your Honors, if you look at that case, you'll see that the Adofina case, nothing here matches Gandy, essentially. Our motivations weren't changed. Mr. Krosky stayed liable on the judgment. He's liable today if we don't succeed here. He still had the same motivation to minimize the amount of judgment that was taken against him. And if I can just say one last thing, Judge. Gandy does say that the insurance company has the right to make a good faith effort to adjudicate coverage, but absent the reservation of rights letter, which is the entryway to that good faith effort, it's not a good faith effort to out of the blue Pearl Harbor like file a lawsuit coverage action against your insured unless you've given them notice that it might happen. And I apologize. Thank you for the.
Now, Mr. Coward, show me that site again. 256 Southwest 3rd.
660, Your Honor. It's the Adofina, Atofina, is the second party, the insured in that case.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Any questions? Thank you.
The court needs to keep in mind this is a summary judgment. What you have before you is a summary judgment in Rust's favor. And if they were relying on something like Jason Thomas being the representative of Farmers Insurance when he signed off on the agreed judgment, they were required to come forth with proof that Jason Thomas had the authority to enter into that agreement on behalf of Farmers, in addition to on behalf of Mr. Krosky, which is the party he represented in that case. So anytime that the arguments are being made by Mr. Cowart, you have to put them in context. They were the ones that had the burden of proof on many of these issues, and the record before you is simply silent on them. So the court erred when it granted their summary judgment. one of the things that he said is the homeowner's policies don't matter because we non-suited our counterclaims on those. Well, Farmers filed the declaratory judgment action under the homeowner's policies and the umbrella, and Farmers wanted the trial court to declare yes or no is there coverage under those homeowner's policies. So simply because they dropped their counterclaim for coverage doesn't mean that Farmers wasn't entitled to a summary judgment in the trial court that the homeowner's policies, in fact, do not cover this. But let's back up a little bit here. They're saying, oh, the homeowners don't, that doesn't matter. We admit there's no coverage under those. Oh, really? Because that's what triggered this whole dispute. Mr. Karosky was sued for a lawnmower rollover accident. He tendered the suit papers to Farmers. Farmers sent him a reservation of rights to the address that was on those policies.
Was there anything other than the statement in the affidavit?
Anything other than what?
To support your claim that they sent the letter.
No. That was.
No copy of the letter was attached to the
affidavit? No, there was a copy of the letter. Yes.
Attached to the
Tony Johnson signed an affidavit attached as a true and correct copy of the letter that I mailed to Mr. Karosky at such and such address.
And the return receipt was with it?
There's no return. It wasn't certified mail. She just sent it regular mail. Now, she sent it to the address on the policies. He says he didn't get it. He says it should say Haltom City, not Fort Worth. But his address on the policy says Haltom City. That's why she mailed it to him. But if there's a fact issue on that, then they certainly weren't entitled to summary judgment when he signs an affidavit saying, oh, I never got the letter. They're certainly not entitled to summary judgment. At most, they would be entitled to a trial. But it all has to be put in the context. Perhaps Mr. Cowart can cite a case for what he told this court that the insurer bears the burden to prove it reserved its rights.
Okay.
There's no
such case.
Okay,
let me tell you something. In the second court, we don't attack the other lawyer. We just deal with the facts and the law. So if you would limit yourself, please.
Okay. I apologize. And I meant no attack on him.
Okay.
There is no case that says that. The Ulico case specifically says if you don't reserve your rights, that does not mean you've waived yourself into changing the terms of the policy. Now, one of the things that came up is he's arguing, well, that only applies to non-coverage. It says you can't waive your non-coverage defense. The distinction that the court is making there, when it uses the word non-coverage, we know what that distinction is when you turn to the McGuire case. Because in the McGuire case, there was an exclusion on an auto policy for vehicles that were regularly, you know, used by the insured regularly, like a company truck or something that they don't list on their policy. And the Supreme Court called that a non-coverage defense. And they said, quote, the doctrine of estoppel cannot be used to create insurance coverage when none exists by the terms of the policy, because Texas Farmers' actions cannot estop it from relying on the limitations of risk set forth in the contract. It is not responsible for the judgment against McGuire. And they characterize that as a non-coverage defense. What they're saying is the insurer doesn't waive its non-coverage defenses, which is if it's not covered under the insuring agreement or if it's not covered because of an exclusion. What it can be stopped from doing is insisting that the policyholder continue to comply with the terms of his policy after it has misled him into thinking that he's going to be covered. In this case, to put that in the context of this case, the timeline is very important because on October 23rd, 2009 is when Mr. Karosky was sued. The reservation of rights went out 1 month later on November 25th. In January, Farmers filed the declaratory judgment action. They want to say, oh, well, he surely has the right to know what the insurance company planned to do. Farmers filed a lawsuit saying, we don't think you're covered, and we're asking the court to declare that you're not covered. And then after that, after he received that, is when he went out and breached the terms of the policy.
I have a question. I know your time's out, but I've been thinking about this a lot. Did the record in the trial court reflect whether Mr. Thomas was fully paid by Farmers and not paid at all by Mr. Cross?
It did. I believe it's on page 164 of the record, if I'm not mistaken.
That all the money that he received from being defense counsel came from the insurance company.
Right.
And how much was that? Was he continued to be paid after the date of the filing of the declaratory judgment action?
Yes. So the timeline that I was just going through, they hired him, I believe, around November of 2009. The DEC action was filed in January of 2010, and then the agreed judgment was entered into in February of 2010. He never really got a chance to defend Mr. Karosky. Never really got a chance. A couple of months into it, he agreed to a judgment against himself. But I believe on page 164 in the record, it shows that Farmers paid all of the defense costs.
But he did sign, Mr. Thomas did sign off on the agreed judgment.
He did.
Okay.
As his counsel.
Thank you for answering my question, sir.
Thank you. Appreciate the court's time.
Anything else? Thank you. Well, we appreciate your coming this distance, both of you, to argue this. It's been very helpful. You've answered many of our questions. Your case is submitted.